We're going to just give you a brief overview first here on chapters 13 to 23 based on Samuel Schultz, The Old Testament Speaks, the survey I used as an undergraduate student, and pretty good in his treatment of Isaiah. What we have in these chapters is a catalog of oracles pronounced by the prophet about the different nations around Israel and Judah. And interestingly, Assyria is the dominant threat to them. It's not correct of me to say in the notes that it receives very little attention. It receives a lot of attention, but there is no oracle addressed to Assyria. Assyria plays into the other oracles, and that's important for us to understand. But there's no one addressed to Assyria. If there's a lesson to draw from that, it's that perhaps sometimes we are so focused on our immediate circumstances that we lose sight of God's bigger picture. And so, you know, the people are so consumed with Assyria, and what are we going to do with Assyria, that they lose sight of the fact that God has bigger, in some cases better, plans for them than their immediate circumstances that they're looking at in the threat of Assyria. Schultz points out that throughout the section, the sovereignty and supremacy of God is emphasized. Now, this name, Lord of Hosts, occurs at least 23 times in these 11 chapters, so more than two times per chapter. And this is how we translate Yahweh Sabaoth, Lord Sabaoth, if you know that because you sing Mighty Fortress is Our God, I hope, in your worship services. If you don't, you should repent, sackcloth and ashes. Sabaoth literally means armies. Saba is a Hebrew word to wage war, Saba. And this is the most frequent compound name of God in the Old Testament. You know, you have a lot of Jehovah whatever, Jehovah Rapha, Jehovah Jireh, although a true Hebrew speaker would laugh at us saying that because there's no J sound in Hebrew, and so Jehovah Jireh would be something that they've never uttered in their life. But this is the most frequent one, Yahweh Sabaoth, that occurs 285 times in the Old Testament, mostly in the prophetic books. And basically means that the Lord is the commander-in-chief. He's the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies, multitudes. And those hosts might be the angels, might be all of the created order, could be the armies of men, in particular the armies of Israel. Now, in the NIV, anybody here use the Nearly Infallible Version? You did until I made fun of it a couple weeks ago. No, I use it from time to time, and nothing against it. Well, something against it, but not anything major. The NIV renders it Lord Almighty. This is influenced undoubtedly by the Septuagint's choice of the words Kyrios Pantocrator. Now, here the NIV has gone from translating to interpreting. Now, even if they're right in saying that Lord Sabaoth is the Lord Almighty, that's not what the word means. The word means Lord of Hosts. And so it's the task of a translator to tell you what the text says. It's your task as an interpreter to determine what the word means. And when translators move into the realm of interpreting, then they have short-circuited the process. The chairman of the NIV committee, Ken Barker, explains their use of this phrase by saying, "These renderings convey the sense of the Hebrew, namely, he who is sovereign over all the hosts or powers in heaven and on earth, especially the hosts, armies of Israel. But he confesses this does not make clear the distinction between Sabaoth, hosts or almighty, and Shaddai, which can also be translated almighty." Now, I've already told you my opinion. It should be left to its literal sense, Lord of Hosts. Now, in the process of interpreting, you might draw the meaning out of God's royal majesty and the sovereignty of his decrees, and so therefore he is almighty. But what we see with the repetition of this name so many times in the prophetic books, and especially in these 23 chapters that deal with the nations, is that God is the almighty sovereign force behind the unfolding of human history. When we speak of the sovereignty of God, without looking at your notes, what do we mean? What comes to your mind when I say the sovereignty of God?
He's in control.
He's in control, okay.
There's no one he answers to.
No one he answers to. Yeah, that really gets down to the root of the word. It means that his will is absolute. It's not subject to the dictates of another. Sometimes you mention God's sovereignty, and we want to confuse that with his electing purposes or his foreknowledge, or something like that. And those are all attributes of God. But his sovereignty, we mean specifically, he doesn't answer to anyone, as John said. His will is not subject to the dictates of another. Now this is emphasized. You're going to see that the Lord is dealing with these nations according to the pleasure of his own will. He uses nations to accomplish his purposes, and he judges them according to his divine plan, just as he wants to. So finally, then, Schultz says the theme of Israel's restoration and kingdom hopes recurs throughout this passage. It is the Lord of hosts who decreed Babylon's fall. Israel is still God's heritage, even though she is temporarily judged. Not only will the nation of Israel be restored, but aliens, this is people of other nationalities, not of other planets, aliens will be afforded refuge there. Zion was founded by the Lord and will be the recipient of gifts while other nations and kings are judged. A righteous ruler will be established on the Davidic throne. So that's a kind of a good summary of the section we're looking at here. So the first prophecy that we get into, or oracle that we get into, concerns Babylon. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. The oracle here, Masah, perhaps a declaration or pronouncement, literally a lifting up of the voice. So the Lord has lifted up his voice about Babylon. Though Assyria is the most pressing threat, if you look on your maps, you see Babylon is just marked by a little dot. It's certainly more than a dot on that map. It's a region, not entirely powerless and in this time, but Assyria is definitely the most pressing threat. But Babylon was rising strong in that day. As Motyer says, a Babylonian empire in Isaiah's lifetime was a real probability. There was concern on everybody's part that Babylon was going to become a world superpower in that generation. Now, throughout Isaiah, it is clear Judah is going to fall at some point. But most of the time, Isaiah is clear to indicate it's not going to be to Assyria. He doesn't really get around to saying who it's going to be until somewhat later in the book. He's going to say it in no uncertain terms. But here, maybe the people who are hearing him are thinking, what is he talking about Babylon for? I mean, let's hear about Assyria. They're the ones we're worried about. And they don't realize that Babylon will pose a greater threat to them down the road than Assyria does now. Now, verses 2 through 16 contain a picture of the day of the Lord, this eschatological day that the prophets deal with, the day of the Lord. We might call this Judgment Day. This is the day which the Lord has set when he will judge the nations. Now, when is that day going to be? Well, when the prophet's looking out from his vantage point, this is my best picture that I can draw of Isaiah. Kind of resembles him a little bit. He does have two arms and two legs, we understand. He's looking out to the future, and he sees the day of the Lord. Okay? But now, it's kind of like when you're driving up on a city. Okay? You're driving up on a city, and you see, all these big buildings, these big tall buildings that are there in the middle of the city, But what you don't see from the highway are all the little villages and things around the city, you know? And until you get up closer to it, you see there's more to it than that. So the prophet's looking ahead, he says, there's coming a day of the Lord, you know? And we're tempted to think, those of us who hold the young earth creation, yom, it's a yom, it's a 24-hour literal period. No such specification there. As the revelation of God unfolds, we find that the day of the Lord encompasses all the events of the end times, which essentially commences at the first advent of the Messiah, Christ's coming. He comes to pronounce the favorable year of the Lord, and concludes with his second coming. Now, whatever your eschatological view, whether you're pre-trib, post-trib, no-trib, premillennial, amillennial, panmillennial, you know what a panmillennialist is? A panmillennialist is the one who says, I don't know, I just think it'll all pan out in the end. Doesn't matter. The day of the Lord, whatever your eschatological perspective is, the day of the Lord is this period between, well, we didn't say between, the period that began with the first coming of Christ and ends with the second coming of Christ. So for those of us who still admit to being pre-tribulation rapturists, it's becoming less favorable to admit that in these days. People are abandoning that view left and right. Those of us who still admit that would see in here is the rapture, and in here is the tribulation, and in here is the millennium. And then that final battle when the forces of evil are defeated once and for all. All of that wrapped up in this idea of the day of the Lord. And this is going to figure greatly in what we're doing here in these chapters. Now verses 2 through 5, we see lift up a standard on the bare hill. So the standard is sort of a war flag, a visual indicator that a battle is getting ready to take place. It's on a bare hill, so it's on a hill, a high place, so everybody can see it, and it's a bare hill, so there's no trees or buildings or anything that obstruct the view. Everybody will see this flag go up. Raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, I've even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people. A sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. So that's what's going on here. The Lord is bringing an army together. They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons. The Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. Okay, so who is putting the army together? The Lord is. And who is he? Who is his army? What are they going to do? Who are they going to be? They are his instruments of indignation. They are the people who are going to execute his wrath. Because remember, he is sovereign. And yes, they are his consecrated ones. They are his mighty warriors. They are his proudly exulting ones. But they are doing his work. They're not necessarily, these are not necessarily born-again fundamentalists. These are mostly pagans. But God has consecrated them to this task of carrying out his wrath on the earth. And what will the result be? The destruction of the whole land. Probably not a reference to the land of Israel, but to the whole world, in fact. So, I say here in the second square bullet point, this is not a divine endorsement on nobles, consecrated ones, mighty warriors, proudly exulting ones, but rather a recognition that as these carry out their war, they are actually, albeit unknowingly, furthering God's purposes of executing his anger. Assyria has no concept that they are being used by God in the carrying out of his purposes. They're just trying to take over the world. But little do they know that God has given them that much leeway because he's using them to further his purposes. Verses 6 through 8, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp and every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. So this day is near and it is coming. We don't know when, even still, we don't know when. But it is close by and approaching steadily. And it's almost like, you know, when you hear, I remember we used to live on this high, on this hill of a major highway, and trucks come and they would come down that hill, and there's a stoplight at the bottom of the hill. And so long before they got to our house, they would begin putting on those air brakes, you know, and you couldn't see them, and you didn't know where they were, but you knew they were coming. You could hear them just getting closer and closer and closer. And so this day of the Lord is coming, and it is approaching steadily. It's close by. And it will happen, it says in verse 6, it's near, it will come as destruction from the Almighty. It will happen whenever He wants it to, whenever He wills it. And you see the results of it: wailing, terror, pain, anguish, astonishment. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, verse 9 says, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and He will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless, and I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place in the fury of the Lord, at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of His burning anger. I hear that someone is at the door, actually. Can one of you guys go check that? And just it should be unlocked and needs to stay unlocked if that's the case. Thank you. Now, this is an inclusio, these verses I just read. Remember, need to probably remind Bo what an inclusio is, because I don't think he was here when we talked about this. An inclusio is a section of text that's sort of bracketed. Okay, and it'll be a word here and a word here. That's the same. It's not hard to figure out. Inclusio, you're talking about everything being included in between these two brackets. And so 9 through 13 are bracketed by fury or anger. You see, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger. Thank you, Bo. And then verse 13, at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of His burning anger. So fury and anger are the brackets of this inclusio. Is this a term you're familiar with, Bo? Inclusio? Mm-hmm. Okay. We're just saying what it is it's a literary technique where you have a word or a phrase at the beginning and a word or phrase at the end that marks this off as one coherent section.
They also call it a palindrome or something, or that's different?
Maybe.
I thought I heard that.
Does Motyer use the term inclusio? Yeah. Okay. It may be another term for it. I'm not sure. Okay. So now these are not terms that we like to think about. When we think about, tell me what you think about God. I think about fury and anger and burning anger. You know, that's what I like to think about. No, we don't like to think about God that way. But the image here is one of a God whose patience and loving grace has been exhausted, and the limit is reached, and the only recourse now is to desolate the land by exterminating the sinners. Verse 9, it's a harsh phrase there. This judgment will be cosmic. You see in verse 10, the stars and the sun and the moon, and it will be universal. The world, it says in verse 11, I'll punish the world for its evil. Now perhaps in verse 12, the idea of scarcity, I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. It's meant to, again, bring to mind this idea of a remnant. Scarcity does not mean absence. It just means a rarity, you know. So as in the midst of this, as always, it seems like in Isaiah, this devastating judgment, but yet a little glimmer of hope, you know, that that mankind will be scarce, but not completely gone, rare. Ophir is hard to place on a map, but it's referred to in other places in the Bible and usually associated with gold, so it must have been a place where gold was plentiful. And let's see, where do we stop? 13, so 14, and it will be that like a, it will be that like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, they will each turn to his own people, and each one flee to his own land. Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. This is well summarized by Motyer on page 139 with the ideas of no protection, verse 14, like a hunted gazelle or sheep with none to gather them. They have no one to protect them. No escape, verse 15, there's nowhere to hide, and you know, anyone who's found will be thrust through, and the ones captured will fall by the sword. And no mercy, verse 16, they will even plunder the women and children, you see there. So this is characterizing the coming day of the Lord. Now, verse 17, he says, behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will the shepherds make their flocks lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will also live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her faithful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. So the scene at the end here is that all this, you know, vast, what would have been a vast city in Isaiah's day, but would later become a vast empire, Babylon, will be just a place for animals to roam freely through the city. Anybody see I Am Legend? I haven't seen it yet, but the previews that I saw of it came to mind when I thought about these animals just roaming through the streets. You know, here's New York City, you know, in all of its splendor and glory, and wild animals just roaming through the streets of it. That's the idea here. Hyenas howling in the fortified towers and jackals in the luxurious palaces. The Medes are mentioned in verse 17. They're going to be aroused by God, and nearly 200 years after Isaiah's writing, they are going to be the agents God uses to overthrow the Babylonians. Now, who are the Medes? Are they on your map? They are not. Well, the Medes, if your map were accurate, they would be people who live sort of in this area here, and they were on the scene of history very briefly because they were overtaken by one of their subject areas, the Persians. And so you hear about the Medo-Persians. And the Medo-Persians are that mongrel that comes up after the Persians take over the Medes. And they will be the ones who will usurp the prominence of the Babylonians in the world much later. Now, unlike the Assyrians, remember so far we've seen that the Assyrians can be bought off, you know. Everybody that feels threatened by the Assyrians. They send him a little gold, you know, get them off of their back. But just speak up. Say what you want. We'll get it to you, okay? It says in verse 17, they will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. When God raises this group up, you're not going to be able to buy them off or hold them off with your money. History actually shows that. They will come through and render Babylon desolate. Wording is used that reflects the day of the Lord that we just read about, you know, the having compassion on the fruit of the womb or pitying children. And so what we have here is what I think Motyer calls an intermediate fulfillment or an interim fulfillment, something like that, in which what's going to happen in the short run of history is sort of a small picture of what's going to happen in the long run of history. So Babylon, the destruction of Babylon, becomes a reminder to the world that God's got a bigger destruction on the horizon. Motyer says on page 141, the Assyrians destroyed Babylon in 689, after which it was restored. And I would add to that that it was not only restored, but became a major world power. But Cyrus took the city in 539, left it intact. Its continued turbulence led to a determined attack in 518, after which it was declined to desolation. So this came to pass just as the Lord spoke it. In chapter 14, we're still talking about Babylon. When the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. The peoples will take them along and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as they make as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. So, obvious reference to the future captivity. The Lord's going to settle them back in their own land. Wait a minute. They didn't know they were going anywhere, right? Well, you're going to find out later. They are. They're going to be going off to Babylon. But now he's looking beyond that and saying, when the Lord brings them back and settles them back in their own land, then there's going to be others coming with them. Now, the promises about these strangers coming were not fulfilled literally in the return from Babylon. Rather, these are still waiting fulfillment in Messiah's kingdom that's yet future. Jews and Gentiles being united alike in one kingdom. And the church is sort of an interim picture of that. I mean, we are building the foundations of this kingdom, you know, that's been promised from Isaiah and others that there's going to be a time when Jew and Gentile alike are brought into one family. And that's what the Church of Jesus Christ is supposed to be. That's why I get a little irritated when everybody wants to plant a church targeted to one specific group of people, because we're supposed to be tearing down those walls and bringing all those people into one family and not saying, there's going to have a little Jewish group over here, a little Gentile group over here, a little cowboy group over here, a little punk rock group over here, a little urban group over here. No, we're supposed to be uniting people together, tearing down those walls of division, not building them back up. It's funny. What was decried as segregation in the 1960s is called strategy today in the 21st century. And that is used to be exclusivism and segregation, and now it's targeting and strategic outreach, you know. And please, a skunk by any other name still stinks. So we are doing this work of, or we should be, of bringing in the strangers along with ourselves. So these conditions are a foretaste of the kingdom to come, and just like Babylon's destruction are a foretaste of the day of the Lord, so the return from Babylon is a foretaste of the kingdom that's to come. Now, once the captivity is over, it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you've been enslaved. that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. So Israel is going to, they're going to mock the king of Babylon after the captivity has ended. And what we have here, down to verse 21, is an entire poem that pictures the downfall of this egocentric Babylonian king. He is an oppressor and a destroyer. And so when he is cast down, you see in verses 7 and 8, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They will break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. So the people and the land rejoice when the king of Babylon is destroyed. We see him in Sheol in verse 9. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. The death itself is glad you're there. And Sheol should not be understood exclusively as hell. It is the place of the dead in Old Testament thought. It's a sort of... I don't want to get sidetracked on this because we don't have the time. But if you take all that the Bible's saying about Hades and Sheol and hell and heaven and paradise and all that, what it seems is that when a soul dies, they go into Sheol, which may be sort of like this with Hades or sort of the place of the unrighteous dead, and then paradise, the place of the righteous dead. And then when Christ comes, he leads forth a host of captives. Ephesians 4 says, what does he say to the thief on the cross?
Today
you'll be with me in paradise. Three days later, what does he say to Mary? Don't touch me because I've not yet gone back to the Father, right? So where has he been? All right, now, this is tough stuff to deal with, and this is just one way to tackle it, and I think that there's some truth here, is that what he's done is he's come down into Sheol, and he's leading out this this group of captives into the presence of the Father, into what we call heaven. Okay? And we know there's going to be a new heaven later, but it's heaven where they will await the resurrection, although some people got to experience that. Because remember, Matthew tells us in his last chapter that when Christ arose that some of the graves were opened and the dead were seen walking around. Not much commentary on that verse in any of the works on Matthew, you know. Nobody wants to deal with that one too much. And then the unrighteous dead, you'll find at the end of the book of Revelation, what happens is that death gives up the dead that were in it, and those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life, which are none of them at that point, they go into hell, the lake of fire, everlasting torment. So when you read about Sheol, by the way, Butler, I think, gives you a good overview of Sheol on page 51. It will just suffice to say Sheol is the place of the dead, the righteous and the unrighteous who are awaiting their eternal, destinies. Now, the arrogance of this king is so great that he seeks to exalt himself even above the Lord. You see in verse 13, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Now, you have a question.
I do. I thought the person that I usually introduced to what Lucifer said.
They are, and we're going to get into that. But let me ask you a question first. Is there anything in Isaiah 14 that tells you that this is being directed to Satan? Nothing.
No, it also talks about the king of Babylon.
The king of Babylon. Yeah. And, but, we do... typically say this is talking about the fall of Satan. Now, so here I've given you some information from Robert Leitner. He's got a pretty good topical study on angels, Satan, and demons, in which he says, all agree that the historic king of Babylon is in view in verses 1 through 11, as named in verse 4. So verse 4, the king of Babylon. And he says, everybody agrees that's who we're talking about up to verse 11. But see in verse 12, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. And so Leitner says there's disagreement over whether the star of the morning discussed in verses 12 through 19 is the same as the king of Babylon discussed in verses 4 through 11. Now some say the entire passage applies to the king of Babylon. This king was later viewed as a type of the Antichrist, who in the Great Tribulation will set himself above every so-called god or object of worship, displaying himself as being God, 2 Thessalonians 2:4. Others say Isaiah spoke only of the pride and downfall of the king of Babylon, a man who made the earth tremble, overthrew its cities, took many people prisoner, and yet did not even have a decent burial, verses 16 through 20, for he was thrust down to Sheol. Still others suggest that verses 12 through 15 is a song metaphorically portraying the city of Babylon as a god. And some say the passage speaks of both the human king and Satan, who energized the king. So some would say, and it's a pretty plausible suggestion, that we move easily between the king of Babylon and Satan, because who's behind the king of Babylon? Satan, right? But we have to be careful, because who really raised up the king of Babylon and who brought him down? The Lord, right? So let's not confuse, let's not do like this singer who says, the devil messed up my tapes and I had to sing another song, you know. Maybe it was God that was doing that, you know? So, everything the devil does, God has allowed him to do. Yes. Because he is. He wants to destroy you. He wants to devour you. He wants to sift you like wheat. But he only has a limited sphere of permission from God, you know. So God is not going to allow you to be tempted beyond what you can stand, because So what does that mean? When you get to that place where you say, oh, it's too much, I'm going to give in to it. No, God knows that you can overcome that, you know. But just like Jesus' temptations, you know. What does the Bible say? Why did Jesus go out into the desert? To be tempted, yes, but what caused him to go out there? The Spirit of God compelled him to go out there. Yeah, and so, you know, it's true. God does not tempt us, James says, but God will allow us to be tempted. And otherwise, I think the Lord's Prayer is meaningless when we say, lead us not to temptation. I mean, he will lead you to temptation so that he can prove us, you know. So we have to be careful sometimes with our attributing something to the devil, because he's only operating in the sphere that God has allowed him to. Well, Jesus gave us some fingerprints of the devil to look for, didn't he? The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And so when you see those things, you know that he's at work. Great point that was brought out in the conference I attended this weekend. Joel Beakey, I think it was, preaching on, yeah, it was Joel Beakey, this passage where Jesus says to Peter, Satan desires to sift you like wheat, but I've prayed for you. The you, in the first statement, he desires to sift you, is plural, all of you, but I have prayed for you, singular. I just said, I could go home now. That's enough. I mean, to think that he is, you know, praying for me. He's interceding for you by name, individually. Satan's desire is to destroy us all, but the Lord is uplifting each one of us. Well, we digress somewhat. The star of the morning, literally the shining one, verse 12, seems to refer to Satan. This is Leitner's words. Verses 12 through 14 describe his sins. Verses 15 through 19 speak of his downfall. Five times in verses 13 and 14, this morning star said, "I will." Leitner says these statements seem more fitting of Satan than of a human Babylonian king. In fact, to me, the one statement that kind of convinces me is, "How you have fallen from heaven." Unless this is using sarcasm, you know, which is possible. Isaiah does use some sarcasm. But the sarcasm, you know, like to say, you know, you've really built yourself up here like the Tower of Babel, you know, wanting to reach to heaven. There's sarcasm in that passage. They built as high as they could build, right? And what does it say the Lord did? The Lord came down to see what they did, you know. Well, he says these are more fitting of Satan than of human Babylonian king. No one knows for certain when Satan committed this awful sin of arrogance, which sealed his eternal doom. We do know he and other angels sinned before our first parents sinned, because Satan was there using the serpent in the garden to tempt them to sin. When Satan sinned, he was fallen from heaven and cut down to the earth, as verse 12 says. The star of the morning, the son of the dawn, became Satan the deceiver. He weakened the nations, made the earth tremble, shook kingdoms, made the world like a wilderness. In the future, Satan will be thrust down to Sheol, and ultimately his eternal destiny will be in the lake of fire. So that's Leitner's description. Grudem says this, as Isaiah is describing the judgment of God on the king of Babylon, an earthly human king, he then comes to a section where he, not gegens, but begins, typing fast there, where he begins to use language that seems too strong to refer to any merely human king. It would not be uncommon for Hebrew prophetic speech to pass from description of human events to descriptions of heavenly events that are parallel to them, and that the earthly events picture in a limited way. In fact, and I point out here in the notes, this has been done twice already. The fall of Babylon is a picture of the day of the Lord. The return from captivity is a picture of the kingdom of the Messiah. So here the fall of Babylon's king is a picture of the fall of Satan. Similarly, we could lump into this discussion the lament against the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28. Usually when you hear a good rousing sermon about the devil, you're going to go to Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. And there again, it's just like this. There's nothing in the passage that singles out the devil. We're talking about an earthly king. But the language moves a little too fluidly between earthly and heavenly scenes, you know, and so we get the picture that something more is going on there. Now, if these verses depict the fall of Satan, then what is the message of the prophet, right? That's the, you know, if you nail down that the fulfillment of this is the fall of Satan, you still haven't dealt with the message. The message of the prophet is that King of Babylon's fall will be like the fall of Satan. David Jeremiah writes about both of these passages, Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. Here's a good way of looking at these passages. They point both to the earthly kings mentioned and to Satan, in the same way that some of the messianic passages point both to the Davidic kings of Israel and to Christ. They find their fulfillment on more than one level. I won't chase that rabbit. Let's just leave it at that. David Jeremiah said it, amen. all right, verse 22. I assure you that's not original with David Jeremiah. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. Isaiah's imagery is just incredible throughout the book. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. That's a very vivid way of saying that. I don't want to move on too quickly. Are there any other questions about this passage that deals with the fall of the king of Babylon and the fall of Satan?
I'm going to be honest with you. Before that, I've got issues.
Okay.
Back to Sheol.
Okay.
Get that straight.
Yeah, well, let's don't...
I don't want to do too much, but yeah. I just want you to help me reconcile that. I've never heard that put together.
Oh, really? Okay.
I've never heard that put together, that you'll be with me a day in paradise, and then yeah. later, I'm not going to be the father.
Yeah.
And then you reconcile that with 2 Corinthians 5.
All right. It is now.
What's that?
It is now. Because he's already done this.
But not then.
But not then.
Okay, praise the Lord.
Yeah, right. No worries.
My mind was going, wait a minute.
Last week I was denying the virgin birth, and this week I'm instituting some new kind of Protestant, some new kind of Protestant purgatory here. No, yes. Now, following this, be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Raymond?
John MacArthur, the first one I've heard to repeat that, and he said it was erroneous rabbinical belief.
This? Yeah. A lot of guys don't hold to this, you know, and I've heard some good arguments against it. But I still think, even if this is not precise, there's something to it, you know, because you do have this idea of Sheol, you know, of the, being the place where even the righteous go. And
well, they talk about the great gulf.
The great gulf fixed.
And the people on the righteous side.
That's right.
The people in Hades begging for water.
That's right.
If it weren't for the gulf, they would go and give them water.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I mean, you know, it's and maybe I don't know. Maybe I don't want to say too much about it. I tried to put something together for you guys about this, and I just thought we don't have time. We don't have time.
I'm going to send you, I went to this Bible study where this Baptist preacher did a really good presentation of this with verses to look up.
Yeah.
And I'm going to send that.
That would be helpful if I actually used the Bible to present this. No, I worked for about 2 hours putting a scriptural picture and a visual with references and everything together, and then I just thought, if it's taking me 2 hours to prepare it, how long is it going to take me to go through it? And we don't have that much time. So, yeah, just, I don't even think I saved it. Do some study on this in some good, I wouldn't go to Wikipedia for this, but go to your Bible dictionaries and commentaries and things on Sheol and Hades and look and see. I think this is commonly called the compartment view. And there are some people go really haywire and astray with this, but and it's been well refuted by some scholars. But I still think that there's more to it than we're willing to give credence to.
Well, BC does it for me.
Yeah.
That helps me.
Right.
I don't want to chase anything, but if you ever decide to take some topics like this,
yeah.
and just put it together and want to invite some to comment here, I'd like to comment.
Okay.
Seriously.
Okay. How many of you have Sunday night services at your church? Anybody have Sunday night services? Okay, not for this, probably the rest of the summer, but maybe starting in the fall. What I usually do on Sunday nights is sort of like this. You know, I take I've done basic Christian doctrine. I've done understanding your Bible, overview of church history. I do for 8 weeks. And just do a one-hour presentation for 8 weeks in a row on that theme. You know, so if you don't have Sunday night service at your own church and want to come to that, 6 o'clock on Sunday nights, but I don't think we're starting it up again until the fall. If we change that, I'll let you know.
Can I be legalistic and command my whole flock?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be disappointed if you didn't. what time have we got?
7:20.
Let's go 15 more minutes. And John, you're the timekeeper. Okay, so in this 24 to 27, which I read but didn't comment on. So no more questions on the Satan issue?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm...
I have one little thing.
Okay, yeah.
My book, instead of translating it, the morning star or the shining star, it actually said Lucifer.
Okay.
Lucifer means the shining one.
Latin, yeah, Latin.
And Lucifer, well, I mean, it's another name.
Yeah, yeah. And that's borrowing from the Latin for that. You know, I don't think we should go from Greek and Hebrew into English by way of Latin. But that is what's been done in some translations. Okay, just interesting. You have the MacArthur Study Bible, Andrea, and Raymond has said that MacArthur doesn't like my view of Sheol. So does he say anything there? And of course, this is written by his faculty, not himself. Do they say anything on verse 15 about Sheol?
He says, let's see, 14, 15.
Mm-hmm. He says on 14, he says hell, and then he says Sheol. The two English words represent the same Hebrew word. Those kings of the nation are already in the place of the dead, say they work upon it for the rising king of Babylon.
Place of the dead. That's what I said it means, place of the dead.
But he called it hell, that's confusing.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean hell. It means the place of the dead. Because you got righteous people talking about Sheol in the Old Testament too, you know.
Then he says in 14:15, he called before Sheol in the pit. Therefore, it's those who try to...
Yeah, I mean, the idea of hell may be present in the pit there, but not in the word Sheol. Okay, so verses 24 to 27, we have a declaration of the end of Assyria, just as the advance of Assyria takes place under the providential direction of the sovereign Lord, so also their fall will happen according to his plan. Assyria will be destroyed, it says, in my land. If you look at verse 25, to break Assyria in my land, the Lord says, and trample him on my mountains. Isaiah 37 will tell us that this happened just as prophesied, and we'll have to wait to get there to see. But the Lord's dealings with Assyria show us how he's going to deal with all the nations. He says in verse 26, after he talked very specifically about Assyria in 24 and 25, he says in 26, this is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that's stretched out against all the nations. So, again, we've got one of these pictures of a smaller event, depicting the bigger event, the crushing of Assyria, depicting what will happen to all nations. And this ends the inclusio that began at 13:1. In 13:1, well, in 13:2, wave the hand, all right, and then verse 27, 14:27, as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? So we've got a bracketing there with the use of the word hand. That's not always the case when you have repetition, but it does seem to mark out the section there. Okay, now we have the oracle concerning Philistia, 28-32, in the year that King Ahaz died. Does that sound familiar? Sounds like 6:1, doesn't it, in the year that King Uzziah died. In the year that King Ahaz died, which would have been 715 B.C., so Isaiah now had been a prophet 25 years. This is 7 years after the fall of the northern kingdom. The year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you. Philistia was a very splintered nation, and so he's saying, you know, all of you. For smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. This smoke is probably the dust flying from the horses on the march, you know, speeding down. And there's no stragglers in his ranks. How then will one answer the messengers of the nation that the Lord has founded Zion and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it? So the idea here, I skipped down to verse 32 from where? From verse 29, I'm sorry. I'm looking at too many things. The rod that struck you is broken, for from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. Those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security. I will destroy your root with famine, and it will kill off your survivors. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you, for smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. How then will one answer the messengers of the nation that the Lord has founded Zion and the afflicted of his people seek refuge in it? So what's apparently happened is that the Philistines have heard that Ahaz died and they've sent some messengers over. You see the reference to messengers from the nation in verse 32. And they basically are saying, you know, to them, hey, you don't have a king, so come and join us, and we'll fight off these Assyrians together. You know, and now, finally, we can have Israel to ourselves. You know, the Philistines have wanted to control Israel since the days of Samuel, you know, and so, and before. And so, they've sent messengers over there. And they've come to solicit the partnership of Hezekiah, who was co-regent. You remember from our introduction study, he was co-regent with his father. He's Isaiah is sort of telling him, you know, don't team up with him. This is what you're going to tell them, that we trust in the Lord who has founded Zion. I won't get into the various interpretations on the rod that struck you. My notes will tell you more about that. I side with Motyer, so you know I'm Orthodox. The message for the delegation from Philistia is, we don't need you. Just as Isaiah counseled Ahaz not to worry about the Syro-Ephraimite coalition, not to seek the safety of allying with Egypt or Assyria, so Judah needs to not look to Philistia and their offer of alliance. They must trust God to save them, because Philistia is going to be judged soon. You see that in this section. There's smoke coming from the north that's going to devour them. They won't be able to help Judah at that point. Okay, let's take a break. What time you got?
7:35.
Let's be back 10 till. According to John's watch. Everybody sync with John.
He said, no.